A large segment of the lesbian and gay male population frown on drag queens, who are seen as mocking women, all the more so because they get themselves up in the most retardatory female guises, showgirls, prostitutes, sex kittens, Hollywood starlets. This rejection of transvestites has been cruel and perhaps not well thought out. As long ago as 1970, Kate Millett in Sexual Politics saw the drag queen in quite another light, as a useful subversive. And this is what Kate Millett wrote. As she minces along a street in the village, the storm of outrage an insouciant queen in drag may call down is due to the fact that she is both masculine and feminine at once, or male, but feminine. She has made gender identity more than frighteningly easy to lose. She has questioned its reality at a time when it has attained the status of a moral absolute and a social imperative. She has defied it and actually suggested its negation. She has dared obloquy, and in doing so has challenged more than the taboo on homosexuality. She has uncovered what the source of this contempt implies, the fact that sex role is sex rank. Anyone familiar with drag knows that it is an art of impersonation, not an act of deception, still less of ridicule. The drag queen performing in a nightclub, for instance, is often careful to reveal his true masculinity, deep voice, flat chest, short hair, at some point in his performance. Such a revelation underscores the achievements of artifice. Since, in addition, the majority of gay transvestites is from the working class, and many drag queens are either black or Puerto Rican, discrimination may be both snobbish and racist. The greatest irony is that the Stonewall resistance itself and many of the other gay street actions were led by transvestites. As for why drag queens have singled out prostitutes and showgirls to imitate, the explanation may be at least partially historical. Certainly gay men have seldom impersonated middle-class housewives or aristocratic hostesses or women students. The gay hissing and bitch sessions, the vulgar put-downs, and the half-funny, half-serious rivalries parallel the catty remarks of whores and chorus line gypsies. In gay American history, one discovers several clues. An article published in 1896 about the fairies of New York states, they are fond of the actor's life, and particularly that of the comedian, requiring the dressing in female attire and the singing in imitation of a female voice, in which they often excel, unquote. Testimony given to the New York police in 1899 has this to say of male prostitutes. These men that conduct themselves there, well, they act effeminately. Most of them are painted and powdered. They are called Princess This and Lady So-and-so and the Duchess of Marlborough and get up and sing as women and dance, ape the female character, call each other sisters, and take people out for immoral purposes. In 1893, a medical journal published a note about a black drag ball in Washington, D.C. Quote, in this sable performance of sexual perversion, all of these men are lasciviously dressed in womanly attire, short sleeves, low-neck dresses, and the usual ballroom decorations and ornaments of women, feathered and ribboned headdresses, garters, frills, flowers, ruffles, etc., and deport themselves as women. Unquote. Obviously, then, many of the early drag queens actually were prostitutes. Others, such as the black queens in Washington, may have found that the world of the theater and prostitution was the only one where overt homosexuals were welcome. Or perhaps the assertive make-believe of such women, purveyors of sex and fantasy, seemed naturally related to the forbidden pleasures of gay men. Or perhaps the assault on convention staged by prostitutes and performers appealed to gay men because it was a gaudy, if ambiguous, expression of anger. In any event, this legacy can still be faintly heard in gay speech today, though less and less often. Much more hardy is a small but essential vocabulary derived from prostitute slang, including trick, a casual sex partner, box, the crotch, trade, one-sided sex, number, sex partner, John, a paying customer, to hustle, to score, to make out, and so on. Few young gays, however, know the origins of these words, and certain locutions borrowed from prostitutes have been modified in order to obscure their mercenary connotations. For instance, few homosexuals still say, I'd like to turn that trick. Instead, they say, I'd like to trick with him. That homosexual slang should be patterned after the slang of prostitutes suggests that in the past, the only homosexual men who dared talk about their sexual tastes and practices either were prostitutes themselves or lived in that milieu. Curiously, that vocabulary has flourished among gay men who have never dreamed of selling sex. There's no class of people more despised both by other homosexuals and by heterosexuals than drag queens. Some gay men, perhaps most, feel offended by drags. Drags are experienced as strange, interstitial creatures, and their effeminacy is regarded as a blight on masculinity and as a caricature of femininity. Most people, it seems, whether straight or gay, feel awkward around drag queens, uneasy, even frightened. So many of our social responses are dictated, either consciously or unwittingly, by our recognition of someone's gender, which we generally assume coincides with his or her sex. Confronting a man dressed as a woman jams our social signals and frustrates our habitual social responses. If we can be temporarily alarmed by a foreigner who greets us in a strange way with a kiss on both cheeks or on the hand, then small wonder that we are even more dismayed by someone whom we don't know whether to call he or she. Our social intercourse depends on a conformity to external rituals and admits with comfort only internal diversity, an original opinion expressed over a very conventional dinner, for instance. But mere social discomfort is the least of our problems. The largest one is the threat posed by the drag queen to our sense of identity, which is invariably linked to our sense of our own gender. It has become fashionable to say that a man secure in his masculinity will not object to transvestites. And undoubtedly, it is true that the real drag queen haters among men are those who experience their own gender as fraudulent or at best shaky, just as the most belligerent fag baiters are heterosexual men with a similar insecurity. But even the man who is sure he is a man, or the woman who is sure that she's a woman, may find a drag queen queasy making. The sources of this queasiness, I would guess, are both historical and, if I may use the word, cognitive. Historically, gay men have been unfairly branded by straight society as effeminate, as always effeminate. Since 1969 and the Stonewall Riot and the birth of gay liberation, homosexual men have rigorously discarded the effeminate label, and if seen in the correct light, this redefinition can only be commended. Social labels have a nasty way of defining behavior even to the defined. We can imagine that before black power, some blacks may actually have experienced themselves as shiftless, lazy, childlike, and we know, sadly enough, that some self-hating Jews attracted to Richard Wagner's anti-Semitic circle went so far as to commit suicide in order to free themselves of their hated Jewishness. Homosexuals, like other minority groups that have developed a taste for freedom and self-respect, have rejected the demeaning stereotype of effeminacy. Today, many gays are even going a bit overboard and dressing in lumberjack outfits and as cowboys, truck drivers, and so on. We are all assuming the most blatant badges of manliness, in which in America, curiously enough, is always associated with the working class. I see nothing surprising or distressing about this development. After a period in which homosexual men dressed in fluffy sweaters, dyed their hair, owned 20 bottles of cologne, all with pebbles at the bottom, and stood around piano bars singing Hello, Dolly, we have entered a period no less congenial, in which we swill beer at leather bars, sing along with country and western tunes, and have stopped using even deodorant. The drag queen, always a tentative figure, appears all the more isolated and fragile among so many burly men. She is also the more despised for her very presence, since she reminds many of what could be called the new macho fascists of the shameful homosexual past. At the very moment when many homosexual men are learning that they can be both gay and butch, along comes this bizarre specter, teetering on spike heels under pounds of lacquered hair, her face painted and powdered above her prominent Adam's apple, her clothes a fantasy of outdated frills and finery. Historically, then, the drag queen stands as an unpleasant reminder of discarded effeminacy. But I have also said that she makes us feel uneasy on a cognitive level. As many of you no doubt recognize, psychologists, anthropologists, and other scholars in the social sciences have been investigating the characteristic ways in which the human mind organizes and analyzes experience and information. And this area of research has been dubbed cognitive psychology. I am by no means well-versed in this kind of speculation, but it strikes me as a preoccupation of linguists such as Noam Chomsky and so on. Certainly, I am blurring the important distinctions between all the different groups, but it does seem to me that what is happening today is that people no longer think of human nature as almost infinitely plastic, a pure product of acculturation, the result of nurture rather than nature. But today, the vanguard of social scientists is finding deep structural similarities among even the most diverse people. Despite surface variations, there appear to be abiding categories of thought that are perhaps wired into our brains. For instance, there seems to be among all known languages more profound congruities than there are superficial differences. Similarly, there appears to be a universal human urge to set up experience in pairs of opposites. The exact contents of these categories may differ, but the drive to make such distinctions prevails. Some of these pairs that spring to mind are pure and defiled, sacred and profane, and so on. Surely one of the most enduring of these dichotomies is male and female, or rather, since we are speaking of gender rather than sex, masculine or feminine. In almost every group of people, a great deal of effort is expended in order to make these distinctions as clearly marked as possible. Differences in dress, vocabulary, sports, jobs, manners, attitudes, and so on. But oddly enough, even when these gender distinctions are de-emphasized, the separation between masculine and feminine continues. For example, a few years ago, a group of feminist teachers worked with kindergartners in an environment where boys and girls were encouraged to dress, speak, and play alike, and where all gender differences were discouraged. Despite such efforts, the children remained acutely aware of gender distinction and could be overheard saying, "Boys don't do that, that's only for girls," and so on. This mental habit persisted even when the particular gender-identified behavior was precisely the opposite of what the society at large regards as proper masculine or feminine behavior. Thus, a boy might be heard saying to a girl, "Don't touch my dolls. Dolls are for boys, not for girls." Apparently, gender differences are one of the earliest and deepest pairs of opposites that we adopt, and our sense of our own gender is intimately linked to our very sense of identity, even more closely attached to us than our personal name. I am first a man and only secondarily Ed White. Now, anthropologists in studying other cultures have found that people tend to be suspicious of anything that falls between two categories, that is, interstitial. For instance, look at the ancient Hebrew food taboos. Some people like to assume that such prohibitions are rooted in common sense, that it is somehow unhealthy to eat crustaceans in a warm climate, for instance. But such appeals to pre-scientific reasoning don't work out very well. No, the Hebrew taboo against lobsters, say, arises from the fact that they are interstitial animals. Sea-dwelling animals, fish, have flippers and swim. Land-dwelling animals have legs and they walk. The lobster or crayfish, however, inhabits the sea but has legs. It falls between two categories and is therefore unacceptable. Not surprisingly, the drag queen occupying the interstice between masculine and feminine is all the more troublesome. Now, interstitial entities are usually handled in one of two ways by society. They are either despised or they are revered. Interestingly, there are several cases, especially among black Americans, of drag queens being revered. When I was in my teens, there was a black transvestite who was the leader of a popular religious cult in Detroit. He was named the Prophet Jones, and he wore makeup, articles of feminine attire, and a full ermine coat presented to him by his devotees. Little Richard, with his lipstick, high heels, satin, and bouffant hairdo, was another such shaman. And other examples of both stars and ordinary people abound in black culture. But if a misfit is not revered, then he or she is despised. And this is the position of the drag queen in both homosexual and heterosexual white society in America. I've spoken about some of the sources of ill feeling toward drag queens, some that are largely unconscious. Recently, however, two kinds of prejudice against drags have developed within the gay community. The publisher of The Advocate, the national gay newspaper, has taken a stand against all forms of eccentricity in gays, and especially against transvestism, on the grounds that unusual dress and behavior can only hurt the cause of homosexuals in general. As long as drag queens, leather queens, leaders of radical politics, and other odd types are unmuzzled and conspicuous, or so the theory goes, then straight society will continue to frown on all gays and deny us our rights. The new advocate line resembles that of the old Mattachine. Gay protesters should wear coats and ties and maintain a thoroughly bourgeois image. Interestingly, the National Organization of Women was faced with an analogous question a few years ago, whether to accept or reject its lesbian contingent. Those feminists who opposed the lesbians did so because they feared that if NOW was linked to lesbianism in the public mind, then the entire organization would be branded and dismissed as crazy by ordinary women. Those who endorse the lesbian contingent argue that if lesbians have traditionally been singled out as scapegoats, then they can just as easily serve as leaders and symbols of feminine solidarity. That is, if male chauvinists attack lesbians for their supposed masculinity and their alleged attempts to wrest away power from men, then very well, the women's movement can turn that insult into an advantage, can say, yes, we women do want power, we do want a larger slice of the pie, and we are invulnerable to your smear campaigns. You cannot frighten us by calling us lesbians because we freely and openly announce that we approve of our lesbian sisters and embrace them. I happen to believe that the decision of NOW to place its lesbian members in an honored position was not only humane but also excellent tactics. I think the position of drag queens in the gay men's movement is quite analogous. Some gay leaders fear that if drag queens remain conspicuous in the movement, then straight society will denounce us all as crazy, weird, impossible. Our acceptance and the gaining of our rights will therefore be retarded. But what these well-meaning leaders do not recognize, in my opinion, is that we are already branded, that if we are out of the closet, then our straight acquaintances already regard us as crazy, weird, impossible, and the fact that we might be professors, doctors, lawyers, or architects in no way redeems us. Those of you who are still well into the closet will confirm my remarks, for you have heard plenty of anti-faggot remarks. Those of you who are out may well have lost touch with this nasty reality. You have been deceived by the hypocrisy of your straight colleagues and acquaintances. And this leads to my main point. All of the objections that you might have to drag queens, that they are queasy, making reminders of the effeminacy of the gay stereotype of the past, that they give us a bad image, that they are disturbing interstitial creatures, all of these objections are precisely the ones that straight men apply to gay men, no matter how respectable those gay men might fancy themselves as being. In fact, I read a study recently that pointed out that I think a group of straight people were asked to look at various images of gay people, and the one that was most disturbing to the straight respondents was the butch gay man. That was the one that got them. That's what they objected to. My point is, we are all outcasts. A recent survey of straights published in the Journal of Homosexuality reveals that straight people do not object to sex between two adult men. What they dislike is self-definition as a homosexual. Coming out of the closet is what riles straight people. You will recall that even Anita Bryant does not object to teachers being gay. She simply does not want gay teachers to announce that they are gay. Once someone comes out of the closet, once a gay man defines himself socially as gay, then he becomes disturbing. As the survey revealed, avowedly gay men are perceived by straight society as women. The anger against gay men, and it is much stronger than the anger against gay women, I think, arises from the fact that gay men are perceived as perverse beings who have willfully forsworn their prerogatives as men and accepted the lower status of being feminine. Straight hatred of gay men is a clear outgrowth of our sexist society, in which men are seen as being superior to women. Because gay men are perceived as choosing to be women, that is, inferior, they arouse scorn, fear, and confusion among straights. It is as though an aristocrat were deliberately to choose to identify himself as a peasant, a deliberate undercutting of our entire caste system. Those in power do not want us to come out. If we continue to define ourselves as heterosexual, if we marry and have children and act like good members of the bourgeoisie, then everything is okay, and we may have occasional romps in the hay with men without upsetting anyone. Or if we keep a sepulchral silence about our homosexuality, things are not so good, but still okay. The moment you come out, however, you challenge the foundations of our sexist society and awaken straight anger. Those of us who have come out are already seen by straight society as drag queens. There's no difference in straight eyes whether we dress in sedate suits, jeans and boots, or little black frocks. We are all pariahs. Since this is so, then it is very important that we endorse drag queens, that we not reject our saints of Bleecker Street. Thank you.
Well, we have the topic, the politics of drag. And I'd like to go back a little bit in history. There were two political components to Stonewall. One was that the drag queens were black, and the other was that they were embracing their femininity, and they knew that if they didn't fight back, they were going to be beat by the cops in New York City. And so that was really where it was at. And so they fought back as men, okay? And they did not want to be put down as men and as women both. The politics of drag, for instance, that in Jamaica now, it's real popular for people to have their hair down. That's a political expression against those who are in power. That's an expression of revolution. When I see drag here as a revolutionary, what is revolutionary to me is when a man who has a beard also is wearing a dress, when both the male parts and the female parts are seen. I do not consider it a good image or a positive image of woman when I see her heavily made up, okay? To me, as a feminist and as a woman, that's pointing out the sex objectification that women have always been burdened under. We are women oppressed by men. In our society, we're oppressed by white men. As far as I'm concerned, we're all oppressed by the white male power structure. When men dress up as women, and they are white men, to me, and they let you still know that they are men, to me, that's still acting out, you know, the oppression of women and their own power, you know, because they're putting down women, you know, as they are acting out. To me, that's still putting women in her place. If we really embrace the feminine, you know, if men really embrace the feminine within them, and they also do not deny their own masculinity in a positive way, in positive images, that's acceptable to me. But I personally have a very hard time with men having images that put down women, that mock them, that objectify women. As a woman, I found it very difficult to be objectified. You know, you just look, and one, they assume you're straight, and two, they assume, you know, something sexual. You know, I've had a very hard time with that, and I can't imagine why anyone else would want it, personally, okay? I mean, that is something as a woman that I don't understand. To me, it's never comfortable to be objectified for no matter what. And I do see that in the drag situation. When I see the men embracing the feminine, like for instance when Craig was really very, very tender, he was embracing and acknowledging the feminine in himself. I do not like, though, put down jokes on women at the same time. That to me is unacceptable. Even though he's very entertaining and he's very much fun, they're put down jokes. And to me, that's an expression of power in our society. That's still an expression of the misogyny that exists in a patriarchal society. Now, if we're in a matriarchal society, maybe it'll be different, right? But right now, we're not, okay? I mean, I'm talking about power, okay, and the politics of you know, gender expression. And that's really, that's what I wanted to say. That's where I'm coming from, and I'd like to just open it up now, okay?
That's what they, I think, would like to call themselves and do call themselves. I mean, I think my basic position is gay unity. I'm just mainly interested in gay solidarity, and I do feel that one of the tasks that maybe needs to be done within the gay community is for drags to explain themselves a little bit better to lesbian feminists. Because I think that, I must say, I'm sort of impatient with the objections of gay men to drag queens. I mean, I find it hard to find in my heart much sympathy for that, because I do feel it's a failure to come to terms with their own effeminacy, generally, their fears of being effeminate. But I think that the lesbian objections to drag queens make a lot more sense, and it seems to me a much more tenable position. I do feel, however, that movies like this are useful in showing some of the inner workings of the drag queen's mind and behavior and so on. As far as calling them she, that's what they call themselves. I mean, if blacks want to be called blacks instead of Negroes, I'll call them black. You know, I mean, I don't see that as I believe in going along with whatever people want to call themselves. If we want to be called faggots, then I would expect everybody to call us that.
You mean that they just purely as a thing? I mean that it's not a person that's real and has flesh and feelings. It's hard to make a general statement, you know. But one of the problems is that if gay men and gay women don't talk with one another, you know, that's real easy to do. You know, that's real easy for a man who doesn't have any contact in a kind of, you know, emotional way with a gay woman, a lesbian, or even a straight woman. It's very easy to objectify and make a thing into something, someone you don't know. You know, that's real easy. And I mean, I don't like to make super general statements like that, but it does occur, and we all know it does occur in our community. You know. Again, but I think it's a question of power. I do think it's a question of power. Men are in power now, you know, and there's a reason why they've kept straight women as Cupid dolls, okay? That was for their own interests, you know, as husbands. You know, they had that interest. And that imagery, there's a reason why they have very placid imagery now of, well, it'll continue of women. It's changing because of the women's movement, you know. Remember, it was the black movement, and then the women, you know, embraced, you know, their own liberations through that, and then it was, it was the gay movement, you know, and the gay movement came because women were beginning to embrace themselves in their own sense of power, in the sense embracing the feminine in themselves. And I think, I mean, and that's, I mean, we still, the gay movement has tremendous potential, you know, tremendous revolutionary potential. We have the potential we have all classes and everybody in it, you know, and we could really have a mass movement in this country. You want me to respond that as a lesbian or as a feminist or as a in the 50s the only role models that we had, of course, were heterosexual role models, right? There was the femme and then there was the butch. The women's movement has changed a lot of that, you know, within the lesbian community, you know. And within the lesbian community, there's still, you know, there's still women who don't understand, you know, the influence and the meaning of the women's movement as far as feminism and breaking down sexual stereotypes. Do I find it personally objectionable? Well, it's a good question. It's complex. On one level, it's a liberating feeling, you know. I mean, she's being herself, and an acceptance of self is the strongest thing you can be, right? I mean, that's who she's accepting, you know. It doesn't offend me. Go ahead. Yeah.
I would like to just mention something that this question brings to mind. When I first started going to gay bars in the 50s, I spent a lot of time at a lesbian bar in Chicago called the Volleyball. And the police regularly raided that bar, and women who were wearing three articles of male clothing or more were arrested for being transvestites. That is, if they were wearing button jeans, boots, and a work shirt, they were drag queens, in a sense. You see, I mean, they were in drag. It was against the law. So that bar had a sign always on the wall that said, "Hobo Party Tonight," meaning that it was supposed to be a costume party. And this sign had cobwebs on it. It had been up so long. And but I do think that sometimes younger lesbians forget that some of the pressures that are on drag queens, male drag queens, are very similar to the ones that used to be directed against women, gay women.
Directed against women, gay women.
Quite aside from the intention, let's say, of the drag queen, what the drag queen's trying to say, it seems to me that the effect upon straight people, let's say, or unliberated women, in seeing a drag queen is to point out how really artificial that particular look was. The fact that a kind of overweight, middle-aged, rather homely man can transform himself into a sex goddess, and some of them are really quite good at that, shows how totally artificial the role was. It seems to me, if anything, it rather than it being a kind of endorsement of that role, I'm talking about the effect, not the intention. I don't know what their intention is in dressing that way. But it seems to me, for me, the effect of seeing a man dressed as a sex goddess makes me feel that there's nothing natural about being a sex goddess, that it's a totally arbitrary thing achieved through makeup, through clothes, through a walk, and so on. And this seems to me a strong statement for women, for lesbian feminists. It shows precisely how arbitrary it is, that anyone could do it. Well, and some of them are really quite good at that. Shows how totally artificial the role was. It seems to me, if anything, it rather than it being a kind of endorsement of that role, I'm talking about the effect, not the intention. I don't know what their intention is in dressing that way. But it seems to me, for me, the effect of seeing a man dressed as a sex goddess makes me feel that there's nothing natural about being a sex goddess, that it's a totally arbitrary thing achieved through makeup, through clothes, through a walk, and so on. And this seems to me a strong statement for women, for lesbian feminists. It shows precisely how arbitrary it is, that anyone could do it. You could probably dress a dog up as a sex goddess if you wanted to.
But the point, I think, Ed, is that's not the way when a woman looks like that. That's not really herself. You know, that's an image that somebody else wants to see. You know, and it is also an extremely uncomfortable image. What I'm talking about when I'm talking about the when a man dresses up like that and what I mean is that that's a stereotype. It's not a real person. And what I feel happens is that they're taking stereotypical things and saying, this is a woman, put earrings on, this is a woman, and then but not getting into what it means to be a woman. And that's what I object to. You know, that there's a kind of with a little bit of here and a little bit of there, that makes a woman. And to me, a woman is a far fuller person. To me, if it expresses the full humanity of the person and the person who is doing it, you know, and the full womanhood and the full manhood, you know, of that person, I don't feel bad about it. You know, if I feel the person come through, but I do not feel that the image that women have had, you know, traditionally, because they have been not in power. You know, I mean, I think it's a question of power. I don't think it's a question of so much of prejudice, you know. I do think it's a question of who's in power and why and how they keep them down. And I think that when you look different than those in power, you know, and you keep looking different, they like that, you know. The shoes that the working people have to buy were not meant to be comfortable, okay? I mean, you know, there's reasons why, you know, we have certain styles that are available to us.
I understand the objection to seeing women dressed in this, objectified role, selling products and so on, the whole image of the sex kitten and so on, and all that coy crap that goes on in television. I mean, it is nauseating. I understand that perfectly. But it seems to me that one of the most powerful statements against that is to show a man. I mean, for instance, a few years ago, there was a model in New York who everyone thought was a woman, who was even on the cover of Vogue. When it was discovered that this person was a man, it horrified everybody because, in other words, it seems to me the statements being made is that this is as artificial as a kabuki dancer, this particular image of women. It has nothing to do with the way women really are, that anyone can do it. It's a matter of artifice. And it seems to me that when drag queens do it as well as women, that what they're doing is they're exploding the myth of this as being the natural look for women. They're showing how totally artificial it is, and that is useful and educational to sexist society. I'd like to respond to a few of the things that have been mentioned. One is that one time I was visiting a friend of mine who was performing in a play in southern Pennsylvania, and I cannot remember the name of this town, but it was a small town. And there was one gay bar in the town, And they had a big drag show where it was a gay bar. It was not a straight bar. It was a where there were drag performers, but it was a gay bar, and it was a special event like Halloween or something. And the women were all in drag. The women were dressed in white tie and tails, and they had reserved tables for themselves, and they came that way. And the MC was a woman dressed as a man, and she introduced the various drag acts, and it was quite a happy affair, actually. It was very pleasant, but it was a kind of real throwback to the 50s. I mean, it was like preserved in amber in this little town, quite a remote town. But I can remember that kind of event in the 50s, even in Chicago and other places. And it seems to me that if you read about lesbians, for instance, in the earlier part of this century, that many of them, of course, did dress in men's clothes and even wanted to look like men and wanted to pass as men. It seems to me that one of the things that drag many that we mustn't lose sight of the class thing here, and that is, it does seem to me that most drag queens are from the working class, and that many times, for instance, in Puerto Rican groups or in black groups, it seems to me, now this is only a hunch, that the role playing is so, the male female heterosexual role playing is so strong that the only way that a person, a gay man, a gay boy, can announce that he is not straight, that is macho, is to turn over like in one night and come out as a drag queen. I mean, I've seen that kind of transformation go from a kind of tough kid who's pretending to be straight and finally gives up and comes out the next day in drag. And I've seen, it's as though there's like this kind of polarity of roles that is so strong that they only have choose A or B. Now, as you move up in the social system, it seems to me that most of the white middle class people in this room, educated people and so on, we all have the same manner. I mean, we make the same hand gestures. In other words, the dimorphism of the sexes is not very strong as you move so-called up in the social system. And it seems to me that there's less of a need, plus the oppression of gays is less severe. But I think that we can say, well, we don't like that sexist society that exists in Spanish culture. We don't like it as it exists in black culture. We don't like it as it exists among poor people. But, I mean, who are we to say we don't like it? And I mean, I'm not only interested in gay lib, I'm also interested in socialism, and it seems to me that to reject the working class in that way and their particular arrangements is a mistake.